Gang, are you a fan of podcasts and Law & Order SVU? Well, I have the show for you. The seminal SVU podcast, Munch My Benson, is the twisted love child of co-hosts Adam Schwitters and Josh Dugan, celebrating the splendid and often wildly inappropriate lunacy found only on Law & Order SVU. Each week, Adam and Josh walk you through a random episode of SVU, all while sharing their smart and hilarious insight. Find Munch My Benson wherever it is you stream podcasts or go to munchmybenson.com for more info. That's Munch My Benson. Let's get down. Attention, Austin guitarists. Are you in need of setup or repair on your axe? Well, I have the guy for you. That's Jason Swedberg over at J. Scott Luthery. Find him at J. Scott Luthery on Facebook. Gang, I've been taking my guitars to Jason for over 20 years, and not only does he do the best job, he's also got the best prices and the fastest service in town. That's J. Scott Luthery on Facebook or jason.swedberg@gmail.com. Gang, whether it's acoustic, electric, or bass, Jason Swedberg is your guy. Find him at J. Scott Luthery. Get your guitars fixed, and let's get down.
And you may ask yourself.
How did I get here? And now here is your host, I'm Johnny.
When we talk. All right, hello, I'm Johnny, I'm your host. Welcome to the show. Oh, man, I hope you guys are doing all right. This has been an incredibly crazy couple of weeks, but hopefully a lot of us are waking up and getting hip to systemic racism. And realizing that we all have to eradicate this from the inside. And it's up to all of us to come together as a country and vote people out of office that are still keeping this horrible system in place. Tear it down. Build it back up with new people, with new ideas that accept all Americans as one. Yeah, it's been a crazy week. I want to thank everyone that reached out and shared the conversation that I had with my friend James Robinson, who reached out to me earlier this week and told me that he thought I should use my show as a platform to talk to my African-American friends in the Austin music community, maybe meet some new people, sit down and have conversations and talk about their experiences with racism and what they think we can do to eradicate it. They'll be coming. There's a lot more to come. I've booked a lot more. These shows are not numbered. I just kind of have these conversations with people. I put them out. They each have individual names. And I want to thank James for reaching out to me and talking to me about it and bringing people in like Bevis Griffin, good friend of mine, and Brandon Temple. I'll be talking to him, be talking to Jonathan Horseman, a lot of different guys. And that'll be coming out, a lot of different guys and a lot of different ladies. I'm hoping to be talking to Jackie Venson and Tamika Jones as well, hopefully in the next week, and bring everyone's story to light so that we can all get on the same page and do what we can to eradicate systemic racism in the United States. Gang, I have a great show for you guys today. The Reverend Sean Amos from the Reverend Sean Amos and the Brotherhood is on the show today. We have a great conversation. Their brand new album, Blue Sky, is out now, wherever it is you stream and download your jams. The Brotherhood consists of legendary drummer Brady Blade, Christopher Thomas on bass, and Dr. Roberts on the guitar. So I got this request from a publicist to have this conversation with the Reverend Sean Amos, and I went and checked out his music. I was blown away, started going through his stuff, and just found this incredible story. He has an incredible story. His mother was a very famous singer in the 50s named Shirley May. His dad is Wally Famous Amos from the Famous Amos Cookies. And as I started researching his stuff, I realized all this different stuff. Like, he made music, he made these like sort of Americana singer-songwriter albums in the late 90s, and then ended up leaving and going to work with Rhino Records and Shout Factory and producing records for Solomon Burke, Hart, all these different great people. And then he came back to this music, the blues, and sort of like infused what he had learned from his America singer-songwriter times and brought it into this blues thing, this new kind of blues thing. And it's really got an amazing reaction. I mean, this record, Blue Sky, has charted all over the place on the Billboard Blues charts, on the on the Apple Music, everywhere. It's getting amazing acclaim and amazing reviews because it is an amazing album. I have a great conversation with the Reverend Sean Amos. And so without further ado, please enjoy my conversation with the amazingly talented and incredibly cool Sean Amos. Let's get down.
You as well, man. You as well. Thanks for the time.
Yeah. So you're in Dallas?
Yeah, I'm north of Dallas in a little a suburb called Frisco.
Okay. All right. Well, that's in your song, so now that makes sense to me.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You wrote this piece that's called Hiding in Plain Sight, and it's in your notes from the Rev section of your SeanAmos.com. And it's very moving. And it's very honest because you didn't, your experience is unique on yours that you grew up in sort of a white neighborhood. And you talked a lot about that, which is pretty different. But there was a lot of blending in that you had to do, a lot of human compromising of your own self to fit in.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've only somewhat recently realized the extent to which I sort of went along with this sort of unspoken set of rules. You know, that if you are a black person who's going to, be lucky enough, chosen to be, selected, luck into whatever, living into a largely white world. There's sort of a set of unspoken rules, that you have to sort of go by. and I quickly fell in line with that. I think to some degree, my mother, I was just talking with someone about this just a few minutes ago, that, I think to some degree, my mother and my father, supported that because, the goal of certainly their generation was, to assimilate, to integrate, to fit in, And I think, and the easier way to do that, the easiest way to do it was to do it on sort of white people's terms. And there's different levels of that, I've realized as I've gotten older, I've tried to sort of undo my whitewashing I wrote about, and try and uncover my blackness and what my blackness means to me. Versus another, because my blackness is different than, a more urban version of blackness. I didn't grow up in the Bronx. I didn't grow up in Detroit. I didn't grow up, in all black neighborhoods. Yet I am black. and yet I have been, the subject of much discrimination over my life. And so, there's sort of a, the reckoning happens at multiple levels.
It does. I thought that it was pretty amazing to talk about that that it wasn't so much about being accepted as much as being understood, which is something that I thought I found eye-opening. You don't hear that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you want to be seen, right? I mean, we all want to be seen,
of course.
And I think that I think for a lot of for a lot of white people who are insensitive to this matter, I think they presume that we are seeing. What do you mean you're seeing? We had a black president. Beyonce is the biggest star in the world. We have Oprah Winfrey.
Right.
Kobe Bryant. Blah blah blah. Of course we see you. We celebrate you all the time. We love Kanye. We love whatever it is. And it's like
right.
That's not what it is. It's deeper than that. It's being understood, and not sort of, you know, making it easy to forgive past or current transgressions, because you know there's some totems out there of success in a predefined sort of, you know, play area, right? You know?
Yeah.
I think as I get older, you know, I realize the importance of being understood and being seen, and how that is different than, you know, acceptance, because acceptance can happen with gritted teeth, you know. It seems like understanding, you know, is a more of an unclenched, you know, version of that.
Totally. And it's interesting because we're the same age, and I was talking to my sister about this. You and I are relatively, mm-hmm. like, I think we're a year apart. I was born in 68.
Okay, yeah, and, 67.
Yeah, and I was raised with a different sort of view that I didn't encounter. I didn't encounter racism until, like, I went to school, you know, until...
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up all over the place, but I encountered the racism when I lived in Lake Tahoe in second grade. Like, I had never heard the N-word. I didn't know that was a word. And we didn't hang out with... My mom didn't have tons of African-American friends or anything, but there was no distinguishing difference between humans,
right?
You know what I'm saying? Like, everyone was just people to me.
Sure.
And so I remember, I mean, it's, you know, my experience is different. I feel like there are just a lot of people, even my own father, who just doesn't get it, you know? It's pretty sad.
There's a lot. That's why we're here. That's why streets are burning, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Because a lot of people don't get it all these years later. I mean, it's, I don't know what it takes. Yeah, I'm heartened to some degree by the many people I've heard from, you know, friends and fans and sort of you know, acquaintances who are younger, who are, you know, in their 20s, early 30s. And for them, this is sort of the first wake up call they've had.
Right.
You know, and you can see the lights coming on, you know, like, whoa, I got a call. I went to a rally on Friday in Dallas, and on my way there, I got a call from a good friend of mine who was in Queens, who's 28, I guess. And he was so shook up, man. I mean, he literally just didn't get it until now. And he wanted to learn a lot and wanted to talk and wanted to express himself, wanted to hear from me. And I'm seeing that a lot, you know, with people who are just like, whoa, I because we, you know, we have the society, particularly in the last 10 years or so, that's so insulated, and, you know, it's social media focused, and so much of the energy is about putting yourself out there, putting the sort of curated, highly stylized version of yourself. And no one has been looking around, you know, we're all looking down at ourselves in these, you know, mirrored phones. And I feel people are finally like the spell got broken a little bit.
Yeah.
The fever got broken a little bit. Hopefully it'll last. But I am heartened by that. And I do think we'll see if it translates into votes and it translates into, you know, engaging in a political process, which ultimately is the only thing that really matters in this country.
Really is. Yeah.
You know, it's, you got to move from sort of, you know, the hashtags to actual, you know, activism and organizing. Yeah. So love and action. You know, that's what I keep saying to myself, you know, love and action, love and action.
Yeah. And you have kids too, right?
I have three kids. Yeah. I have my daughter, my oldest is 19, a college student, freshman, just finished her freshman year. And I've got a son who will be 15 shortly and another girl who is 11.
Okay. It's your oldest daughter that sings with you in some of those videos.
Yeah. She sings great, on Stranger Than Today, the opening track on the album. She's in the video with me. Yeah. That's a precious gift I got with her.
Yeah. That's amazing. Dude, why did you move from LA to Dallas?
I got divorced.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Right. I got divorced, and my ex-wife, her family is from here. And, you know, I'm a traveling musician, or at least I used to be until, you know, COVID.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, I travel a lot and so, yeah, she, you know, she wanted to be closer to her family and have a little, you know, bit of a support group in her new, you know, post-divorce life. And I supported that. And so, and I wanted to be near my kids, you know, so I pulled up and I lived 10 minutes away from my ex-wife and my kids.
Beautiful. That's good, man. Yeah, keeping the family together.
Well, do what I can. I mean, it's a redefinition of family for sure.
Right.
You know? I mean, it's funny. You're talking about black. I mean, it's so much. I mean, I don't know. I mean, divorce is so much of the American experience. Yeah, but it's only a big part of, you know, the black experience as well. And, you know, I just, you know, and I was a product of that. I mean, my parents are divorced and, you know, my father moved away, you know, and that's such a common thing where you get divorced and, you know, the dad splits, you know, and sort of, you know, reinvents his, you know, himself in some new family dynamic. I just, you know, I didn't like being married, but I love being a father. So,
yeah,
you know, I want to stay as engaged and in as close, you know, to my kids as they'll allow me to be.
So yeah,
it was an easy choice to make. I mean, you know, difficult in the execution of it, but an easy decision to make.
Yeah, about, I mean, definitely difficult in the execution of it, and I applaud anyone who takes on whatever challenge it was to move from your home. You know,
yeah, it's radical.
When I was asking you that question because when I read that Cookies and Milk article that you wrote, which is mm-hmm. absolutely fantastic as well.
Thank you.
Regardless of sort of the elements and some of the things that you were facing, it seemed like Los Angeles is in your blood.
Yeah,
like there's some romance in those words when you're talking about it.
Yeah, I didn't realize how much is my blood until I moved here, right? I mean, I didn't realize to what an incredibly, you know, how deeply in my DNA, you know, LA was. Because I traveled a lot, you know, I do travel a lot. And so I always like to think that I had a lot of sort of perspective on LA, and I actually didn't glorify it. I didn't romanticize it. And I was sort of not, you know, part of that sort of stereotypical liberal snowflake, you know, holier than thou.
Right,
you know,
right.
LA's the center of the world. LA's the center of the world kind of shit that goes on in people's minds. But then I moved here. I'm like, oh, fuck. I am like that. I am absolutely that person.
You can take the guy out of LA, right?
oh my God. And just, you know, the, yeah, man. I mean, like you talk about, you know, just the quiet, you know, judgment and, you know, holier than thou thing. And yeah, it was a wake up call for me, you know? And there's lots of problems I have, you know, with Texas for sure. But, but at the same time, and I can't, it is not as easy of a place to sort of paint with a broad stereotypical brush as it was before I moved here. You know, and so it is more confounding than one would think, you know, and it does have these, you know, there's a tension here that is really the tension of America. I mean, it's like, you know, because it's interesting, you know, because Texas sits like right, you know, it's like it's where the West meets the South.
Yeah.
It's where, yeah, I mean, it's sort of like this, it's like right at this nexus of a lot of different, you know, cultures sort of, you know, becoming, you know, going, moving from one thing into another thing.
Right.
And the tension that exists of, you know, whether it's a white patriarchy and their fear of losing, you know, centuries of dominance, or whether it is an emerging, you know, sort of brown class of people, or whether it is, you know, the gig economy. I mean, all these like challenges that are facing us, like this is sort of like ground zero for it in Texas in a lot of ways. And I live in a place, you know, here where, I mean, the reality of it is that it's more diverse here in this, you know, North Texas suburb than any neighborhood I lived in LA. And like when I, you know, my whole life in Los Angeles, I was the only black dude in the room, like every time. And I was amongst all these sort of self-professed, you know, white liberals who
were.
You know, but I was the only, there's no one who ever looked like me, you know, my whole life. And you know, you walk around here and it's like, you could think you're in New Delhi, India, you know, one minute, or you can think you're in Seoul, Korea, another minute. You can think you're in, you know, Tijuana. I mean, it is a really mixed place, and it's mixed in a way that isn't kumbaya. I mean, it's tense. It's
yeah.
You know, not everyone's happy with the arrangement, you know. And then you can see people like missing like the old days, you know. And you can see people are wishing, looking at the side of their eye, this and that person. And it's like that's the reality, you know. That's sort of the rest. So I appreciate that part of it. I really do. And I've never known, you know, evangelicals and Jesus freaks, and I've never known, immigrants. You know, I mean, it's like I'm in touch with, you know, a wider variety of thought, and class here that I've ever been in touch with, you know, in my life, and it's caused me to have to check myself, you know, and in some really helpful ways.
Yeah. That's pretty amazing. It's also funny because I'm in Austin and you're in Frisco. We might be in the same state, but might as well be in two completely different states. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, man. Yeah, I recorded the album just, you know, in Wimberley.
I saw. Awesome. Yeah. Where did you do that?
Blue Rock. It's a Blue Rock ranch. Blue Rock Studios. Blue Rock Studios in Wimberley.
Okay.
Lyle Levitt's done some stuff there. Ruthie, who was on the album, has done some stuff there. It's beautiful. Yeah, it's funny. I'd not been south of Austin before. And that hill country, man, is just really speaks to me. It's very similar to Northern California. It has like a very sort of like Napa Valley kind of vibe.
Yeah.
The rolling hills and the rivers and. There's some wine that they grow there.
Yeah, it's the wineries now.
Yeah. But it was really like a really a introspective place. It was a perfect place for us to make the album. So we just, you know, we just holed up there and locked ourselves up for a week. And it was nice to have no distractions. It was nice to it was restorative, man. You know, to sort of have a piece of Texas, you know, that I could relate to in that way, just geographically, right? I mean, North Texas is so flat. Which is part of like the psychological mind fuck for me.
Right.
For some reason I associate, you know, flatness with barrenness and, you know, and sort of loss of everything. It's just, you know, flatness really does a number on my head. But the hills and the ravines there and the canyons and the greenery is really nice there. And it was helpful for my creative energy.
Yeah. How did you, did you have the songs written when you went in, or did you guys write this? Like I want to clarify for people that are listening that you, it's the Reverend Sean Amos and the Brotherhood, and the Brotherhood is Brady Blade, drummer Brady Blade, Christopher Thomas, the bass player, and your longtime guitar player, Chris Dr. Roberts. It seems like you just call him Dr. Roberts.
Dr. Roberts. Yeah. I mean, Chris is just, I feel like I just got to do that at some point just to, you know, so let the record show or something.
Yeah. Do you write these songs together or do you?
This album was a nice, it's been this sort of, the next step in this evolution of my writing process and my deepening collaboration with Dr. Roberts. You know, I've always been a solo writer. I mean, up until now, I've had very few, collaborative experiences as a writer, because I always wrote from such a personal place and sort of a semi-autobiographical place, and there was just no room for anyone else in that process, and that really wasn't what it was about for me. I was very, you know, writing for me has largely been about, you know, an attempt, you know, it's been self-exploration and attempt to figure stuff out. So, but starting with the last album we did, Breaks It Down, Doctor gave me a riff. He started getting in the habit of just sort of emailing me, or, you know, little MP3 files of little riffs he was coming up with. And he'd been watching me for years at that point. So he sort of knew, you know, what I'd gravitate towards and the things I'd like to sing. So it's really nice. It's like a real gift to have someone, you know, sort of hand you something that is made for you.
Right.
What was I saying, like a heavy metal riff or something?
He took
time to really, like, you know, think about what I would respond to. And so he sent me a lick, and that became a song called Moved, which is on our last album. That's become far and away our most popular song. And it was a great collaborative experience. And so that got us both excited about doing it more. And so when I moved to Texas, you know, I wasn't writing. I was just trying to figure out, you know, put my life back together and adjust to this new reality of mine. And I was you know, frankly, pretty pouty about the whole thing. And so he was sending me little riffs, you know, and they were just great gifts because it took the burden off of me to have to come up with a whole bunch of stuff from scratch. Because I think at the end of the day, for me, I consider myself mainly, you know, a lyricist, you know, above all else. And I'm limited musically, and I'm not in love with, you know, the only instrument I'm in love with is harmonica, you know, and so I can tell. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. I can get on a guitar, you know, just for purposes of, you know, composing some crude, you know, structure, but I'm not a guitarist. I'm not a pianist. I don't like, you know, wake up and think about instruments. So these tracks he gave me were just really a great gift, and it allowed me to just write lyrics and to really, really go deep into lyric writing and to really craft words in a way that was, I was much more meticulous about what I wanted to say and writing and rewriting and rewriting and rewriting and just really thinking about, you know, the structure of these songs. And it also freed me up to write things I might not have written otherwise because the music sort of led me different directions. Right, it was right. Broader than what I've written for myself. So it was great. So that was the bulk. That's the bulk of that album. I mean, it also inspired me to write a couple songs myself. You know, so there's a handful of songs I did write on my own, but the majority of the album are co-writes. You know, me and the doctor, Chris Thomas, our bass player, he sent me a track. He wanted to get in on it. So he sent me a track and that became All Being Blues. And I had a sort of a riff for like a New Orleans brass band kind of song. And so I went to some good friends of mine, the Mudbug Brass Band, and their band leader, Tim Gennard, helped me flesh out the music for that song. And
is that the last song on the record?
Keep the Faith, Awesome Fun. Yeah.
Beautiful song.
So, you know, the whole album, I mean, lyrically, I mean, musically, you know, from, I guess, compositionally, you know, arrangement, recording, you know, the whole thing is really, you know, a celebration of, you know, collaboration. You know, and that's what the brotherhood is to me. I mean, it's literally like, you know, I got surrounded by these people who, you know, could, you know, surround me in love and surround me with their own, you know, skills and allow me to just sort of, you know, have a safe space to go deeper into the things I'm good at.
Yeah. Yeah. And it feels like it's a real band. Like there's some videos of you guys playing together. There's some quarantine ones, which by the way are great.
Thanks, man. Those have been fun.
Yeah, man. You can tell you guys are having fun. Brady, I've been around a couple of times. He did some work with the Sexton Brothers. Do you know Charlie and Will?
Oh, yeah,
Sexton?
Sure. Yeah. Sure. Yeah, not personally, but I know the work he's done with them.
Yeah. And there was something. I was actually talking to a friend of mine earlier, and I was like, weren't you there? I was like, I don't know. I mean, I know I've met him and I was around him. I thought,
yeah, he's everywhere.
I think the world of him as a musician, man.
He's amazing, man. Yeah, he's so intuitive. I mean, he's just pure. I mean, it just comes out of him. You know, he's just so, you know, effortlessly and naturally talented.
Yeah,
it's pretty phenomenal. He's the most undisciplined, you know, person on earth.
Oh, really?
I call him the Keith Moon of, you know, roots rock drummers, because he's just he's so kinetic, and he's such a wild card. You just never know what you're gonna get, and he hates to. He hates to rehearse and he hates to play anything twice at the same time. And it's like, and as maddening as that is, it's part of the magic, you know? And
yeah.
It's sort of like, it's like always flying without a fucking net with him. But that's what's great about it.
Well, he also seems like that's where he shines. Like there are just some people that are best in the moment, you know?
For sure. And CT's like that too. Chris Thomas, we call him CT, you know, and he's a jazz player and CT has played with Brady's brother, Brian, for many years. And Brian, it's funny because Brian's almost like, they're like totally opposite sides of the same coin. Like Brian's very staid and very measured. And he's very much he travels with his own drum kit. You know, he wants no, leave nothing to chance. But he's also very fluid and very intuitive and a wonderful improviser. And so the three of them, I mean, I haven't played with Brian, but, you know, the Blade Brothers and CT, you know, at their core, it's sort of a jazz thing, you know, in that you allow space, you know, you allow room for a conversation, and the conversation may be different in Austin on Tuesday night at the gig than it's going to be in Tulsa, you know, Wednesday night at the gig, you know,
yeah.
And so I had to really, it changed me because the old show I had, and with the old bands, you know, I had a lot of hired guns, you know, and people were coming and going, and I had to really create a very rigid sort of framework to make sure it was going to be reliable. And so there wasn't a lot of room for improvisation or a lot of room for sort of, you know, magic to happen. It was a great show. It was a really entertaining show. And I could, you know, I went off the rails, you know, in a hopefully fun way. But you know, it wasn't a conversation. It was a very scripted sort of affair. But to go on stage or to go in the studio and so it's a, and not know what's going to happen, but know it's going to be really good, that was a different sort of trip for me.
Yeah.
To trust that I can sort of, you know, not be married to any particular outcome, but trust that the outcome was going to be really magical regardless.
Give into the moment, into the song.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who played keyboards on that?
An Austin guy, Matt Hubbard.
That's what I thought when you said, like, go Hubbard. Yeah, Matt's a really good friend of mine. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I love that dude.
That's great.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. And he came in at the perfect time, man. So how did I meet him? Oh, you know, Chris Bell, who was our engineer, introduced us to Matt. And it's funny because he came in on day three, I think, of tracking. And we were at a moment, there's a song on the album called The Pity and the Pain. And it's a really, it's like in 6/7 time. It's a weird time signature. And there's an argument we're having about the time signature. And Brady didn't want to play the time signature. And Doctor was demanding we did. And that was a debate. And it's a sensitive tune. It's sort of like the one sort of fairly pure autobiographical song on the album. It's about the breakup of my marriage. And so it's emotional for me to begin with. And there's a whole lot of tension around that song, and we weren't getting it. It wasn't happening, and the groove wasn't there. And we were arguing, we were pissy, and Matt showed up right in the middle of all that drama, and we're like, "Hey, man!" And we just sent him right to the Wurlitzer, and like, "Here, play with us right now." And he like ended up like just providing glue for that song. And the original demo of that song, it's a guitar lick. There's a guitar hook on that song you hear later on, but it began with just a guitar hook and the vocal. And on the final recording, like the first almost minute of that song is just me and Matt. It's just him, me and the world. It just became like the grounding for that song. And his presence, man, he's just so like, he's so quiet and so like, he's almost like on the spectrum in some way, you know, he's just very like, and he's just sort of like, gets in his own little, you know, world and just lays the stuff out. He's so intuitive, and without saying a word, he just sort of, you know, makes himself at home. It is really, really magical.
Yeah.
His solo on $27 is amazing. That's the one I say, Brother Hubbard.
Yeah.
Great solo. Guy, great player.
Amazing solo. He's gold, man. That guy's vibe wise he's a fucking monster player.
Yeah, and sweet. And he and the Doctor really got along too in particular. We were looking forward to playing with him. We're gonna do some gigs together, and then, you know, all this stuff got blown up. So we're hoping we can play with him live at some point.
Yeah, but man, I mean, doing this record seems like it has it's a special record for you.
Oh yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Not that the others haven't, but it seems like you're in a place right now with this group of people. There were plans in place, I'm sure, to go out and tour. I mean, how did this change what you were doing?
It's just the natural evolution, right? I mean, it's all a journey. You know, I think that it's really allowed me to sort of bridge my past and my present. You know, when I first started playing blues, I've had sort of two musical lives. You know, I had this sort of singer-songwriter, you know, Americana life, and I was, you know, a little bit of a fish out of water in that scene. You know, I mean, I sort of came to the Americana scene like way early, and it was a very white scene, still is for the most part. And I was singing these sort of Americana songs about Black Harlem Renaissance. I mean, yeah, it was just too much too soon for that world to make sense of what I was doing. People talk about those albums now with me. You know, I did an album called Harlem.
Yeah.
And I get a lot of like people coming around going, "Oh my God, that album. But at the time, no one, you know, gave a shit about it. Yeah. Cause I mean, it was just mixing too many languages and too many words anyway. And then I started doing blues. And I felt really at home in that music, you know, and it was really a great moment of self-discovery for me. But I was sort of like, I was, you know, my first blues albums, I was just sort of, you know, trying to do my version of a Muddy Waters thing, or my version of June. I was sort of, I wouldn't go as far as I was being it was a copycat thing, but I was sort of like, playing homage to these, late Chicago, 20th century blues guys who I loved, and trying to do my version of their thing. You know what I mean? I hadn't fully found like my voice in that world, and I wasn't concerned with bringing my singer songwriter voice into it. And so, with the Brotherhood, what's happened is through the nature of the collaboration, it's allowed me to really find my voice, and sort of the kind of roots artist that I want to be. I've been able to sort of pull some pieces from my past into it, and I've been able to sort of define blues on my own terms. And so it feels like, oh yeah, that's us. That sounds like us. There's nothing else that could sound like us but that. Yeah, right. Someone wrote about it. Yeah, how it feels authentic.
Authentic.
It feels much more authentic. I was inching towards it on the last album, that Breaks It Down.
Yeah,
for sure. But even that was like me trying to figure out. I was trying to do my version of Freedom Songs and my version of the Staple Singers.
Right,
and
right.
My version of Curtis Mayfield. Yeah. But it's sort of this is the one where it's like, oh wow, that's us. It doesn't sound like anything else. It sounds like us. And it's pulling from all these things that I was, dabbling in before. But it's made this really unique, whole. And that couldn't have happened without them. I wasn't getting there on my own.
You're right. Yeah, I can totally understand that. And the step that you took with this record really did. I know that one of the challenges when you're doing something like blues is to make it your own.
Yeah.
Take this style of music and run it through the, the meat grinder of you, and what comes out is you. And I feel like you guys really achieved that. There's times when you go to like sort of a traditional song, like the Counting Down the Days, know what I mean? Like that comes out. That's like, what you're hearing when you hear that. But there's other songs, the song right before it, that song, Her Letter, it's not a blues song. You know what I mean? In the way because, that you think
funny,
it is.
It's funny, but it is. But it's, yeah, it's, I actually was thinking of like Robert Johnson and like, Come On to My Kitchen when I wrote that. But I can't play like him. I can't sing like him. So it ends up turning into like some kind of like, wannabe, John Prine song or something. But I think that it's tricky with blues, man. Because it's like, I agree with you saying what you're saying totally. In that, the challenge for a blues artist is like, how do you take this musical form, which is inherently limited? I mean, that's the beauty of it, is that it is elemental and it is simple. And people mistake the simplicity with ease. It's not an easy thing to play, even though it's musically simple, because you got to lead with your heart with it. But how you take this thing and sort of make it your own without sort of being overly crafty, right? At the same time, like blues fans, blues fans are traditionalist, man. They don't want a ton of reinvention. I have found, and so I think that it's a delicate balance of like how are you sort of reverential and carrying this tradition forward at the same time avoiding making it a museum piece,
right? Exactly.
And it's really, really tricky. And even with Stranger Than Today, the opening song on the album, like I want that to be the first song on the album because it really like says who we are, right? If anything, it sort of like has all these disparate elements in it, it's that song, but it opens up like an 808 drum machine, right?
Right, right.
Like, we're gonna get killed. We're gonna get, the blues fans are gonna like, the minute they hear that, they're gonna turn it off.
Right.
But they haven't, and I'm really grateful for that, right? And I think that, and the song's about, in part, about little Walter, so there's a bone there, I guess. But I feel like I've been pleasantly surprised that people have understood what we are trying to do, and that we have, we very much are, fans and champions of the blues at the same time, want to see this thing, live and breathe and have relevance, today. Because, the blues crowds get smaller and smaller every year, man. And they get older and older every year.
Yeah.
And, there's got to be some regeneration going on.
Yeah. And I applaud you that blues are not blues. You guys made an incredible album. I mean, really incredible.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate that, man. Yeah. I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it.
You should be. How did you come to music? Like, there's a lot to your story. I have a finite amount of time, I was told. So I there's a lot out there about you. Your dad, is your dad still alive, or did your dad pass?
He is. He unfortunately has dementia, but he is alive, although not all with us.
Right. Yeah. Sorry to hear that. I'm glad he's here. Your dad is Wally Famous Amos.
Correct.
And your mother was a singer who had hits and everything, Shirley May, and you made a beautiful record about her. You know what? I'm really glad. Can I just tell you this one thing, Sean? I'm really glad that, like, on Friday evening, I decided to, instead of waiting till when I woke up this morning to do all my research about you, for some reason, I just started reading some stuff about you. Mm. And then all of a sudden, you know, I spent the last couple of days listening to records, reading essays, and just really moved by your story. And I mean, it's amazing. And I'll put links to that Cookies and Milk scenes from the 70s childhood. So that people kind of get a sense of this thing. But you grew up like in show business. Your dad was a manager and producer, and you were you were running around the A&M lots and stuff like that. What was it that you called? Didn't you call Herb Alpert Herbie?
Herbie baby.
So when did you come to music? Like, when did this?
I came to it relatively late, man. I mean, you know, I was always creative as a kid. I always wrote. I mean, that's the through line. If there's any through lines, it's me as a writer. I mean, from my earliest memories, I always wrote and little poems, little, you know, rhymes, you know, parody songs. You know, I've always found writing to be a source of comfort and exploration, and just it's always been the best way for me to express myself, the most sort of accurate way for me to express myself. But I wasn't musical, you know. I was a super sort of, I wasn't ADD, but I was very, like, just, you know, I was hyper, and I took lessons, guitar lessons, I quit after a month. I took dance lessons, I quit. I took every lesson imaginable across every sort of art form, and got bored with all of it, and just never showed a real serious, you know, passion towards anything other than writing. And then it wasn't until I went to college where I picked up saxophone, because the woman I was dating at the time said I'd look sexy playing saxophone. Like, good enough for me. and I found I was really intuitive. I intuitively, like, just got the instrument. Like, you know, I took lessons, but I was faking my way reading. I was pretending I was reading, but I couldn't. I sort of understood the instrument. And I joined a band in college playing sax. I left college. I went to film school, and I was, again, pursuing writing, screenwriting. Came to LA, joined a band, like a cover band, because I was the only one who knew all the words to the songs. You know, I mean, I loved music as a student of it. You know, I listened to music my whole life, and so, you know, writing my own stuff and listening to other people's music were my two biggest pastimes as a kid. You know, I had the headphones on with a double gatefold vinyl, and I just, you know, would spend all day listening to albums. I mean, I didn't watch a lot of TV. I listened to albums. I had a huge record collection. I ride my bike down to Tower Records on Sunset Boulevard and, you know, go through the bins all afternoon. I mean, that was my playground. So I was very, very steeped in music. I knew a lot about it. I studied it without knowing I was studying it. But it really wasn't until after I got to college where I took myself seriously as a singer, where I realized, oh, wow, I can sing, you know? And then that led to, you know, songwriting, and I picked a guitar just because I wanted to figure out a way to write my own songs, and sort of went from there. But relatively late, you know, I certainly was not the teenage kid in my room noodling on guitar all day long.
Right. When did you, like, what were you listening to? You said you were listening to everything, but, like, when you decided to start pursuing it, what were you?
I listen. It's funny. My listening is sort of reflective of, like, how I grew up and, like, the things I write about in that essay, you know, I wrote over the weekend and the Cookies and Milk thing, where I sort of had, like, this, like, classic rock, you know, singer-songwriter thing in one ear. And I, you know, as a lover of, you know, Paul Simon and Bob Dylan and Neil Young and all that classic, you know, 60s, 70s songbook stuff, you know, was in sort of in one side. And then the other side was, you know, James Brown and Motown and Sly, you know, and this sort of version of like sort of, you know, proud, semi-militant, you know, blackness. You know? Sure. And those are sort of the two things that were going on, you know, in my musical head. But I love like, you know, I love pop writing, you know, and I love the thread with all that stuff is I was always motivated by things that were largely storytelling driven and lyrically driven. You know, I always listened to lyrics before the groove. Yeah. You know, I always had like a short patience for like the extended jam. You know, I'd get really bored, like more the words. So, but yeah, it was sort of, yeah, and in particular, I mean, I love Pete Townsend. Like that was sort of, you know, like the Quadrophenia album is probably like my favorite album of all time. And like literally saved my life as a teenager.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, just, and I loved Elvis Costello for so many years. And, you know,
I saw you covered Peace, Love and Understanding.
Yeah. Thanks. And I love Joan Armatrading. Black British, you know, singer-songwriter. I love Joni Mitchell. And then, so, you know, it's sort of like this like really super sensitive, sort of introspective, folky stuff. And then, you know, aggressive music, but underlying the aggression is like this vulnerability. So what I like about blues, you know, I've been doing these spoken word readings on Instagram Live. And last night I read the lyrics for Manish Boy, the Muddy Waters song.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a song of, you know, sexual bravado, whatever. But it's also like, I'm a man. I mean, it's like the core of like, it's what I love about the best blues stuff. It's like, it's sort of like this braggadocio that's sort of there to mask an underlying vulnerability. And that's sort of like that tension is sort of what I've always like responded to in music.
Well, that's innate in us, in our animal DNA.
Oh yeah.
Like the peacock, like the, you know, we're just animals when it all comes down to it.
Totally, man.
Yeah. So when you set out, were you like playing like coffee shops and stuff? Like how did you start off that solo thing?
I started off in a band. I joined the first band I joined we called ourselves Earthmen. And then we changed our names to Lucky Sun, S-O-N. And this was sort of like in the, I guess, the early 90s. And so the Sunset Strip scene was happening. And so we played all the Sunset Strip clubs, like, you know, the Roxbury and the Roxy and the Whiskey. And we played the, you know, the Troubadour down in Santa Monica Boulevard and, you know, China Club. And yeah, I mean, all those clubs. You know, we were part of that sort of circuit. And we were just sort of like always just missing out. You know?
Sure.
It's like I remember Hootie and the Blowfish got signed like in 91 or something. And the guy who signed was actually a friend of my father's from back in my father's record business days. And he was, you know, sniffing around us. And I was like I was a black front guy in an all white band. So we're going to be like the next Hootie and the Blowfish. And then, you know, we never got signed. So there's always sort of brushes with like, you know, the label exec, the A&R guy. And we played that game for, you know, too many years to, like, you know, that care to remember. It never happened, never broke, you know? And then that band broke up. And then I performed solo under a pseudonym called Whitey McPherson. Just like this. And if you dig deep, you can find some Whitey stuff out there. But I had my face painted blue. Whitey was like a combination of like Lenny Kravitz, Sly Stone, and Cab Calloway. You know, and like I had like straightened hair, and I had this blue face, and these tight like silver pants, and the skin tight. I mean, it's like ridiculous. And I did that for a while, and we played, you know, the LA club scene, the Mint. And I mean, I was an LA club rat, you know, for years and years and years, and just that's how I, you know, sort of cut my teeth. Yeah. And you name a LA club, but it's a folk club or a rock club. And, you know, I played it, and it just, and I stopped. I did the Shirley May album, which you talked about, you know, in 2005. My mom committed suicide in 2003. She was severely mentally ill. And so I did this tribute album to her.
Beautiful album, by the way.
Thank you.
Really?
Yeah, I'm probably, but it broke me. I mean, it was sort of like, I thought I was done after that. I'm like, I'm done making music. I can't do it anymore. And I was just sort of burnt out with, you know, the near misses with some kind of success, and the, you know, albums that were critically acclaimed but, you know, no one bought them, and I sort of stood up, and so I started producing other people. I got into A&R and, you know, worked with other artists,
became a suit,
and that Yeah. And I loved it, man. I mean, I got to do Solomon Burke's last three albums. I worked with Matthew Sweet and Santa Haas.
Yeah, that's so awesome.
I was in brass band. I mean, I'm proud of my resume as like my credits as a sort of producer A&R guy. It was just as creatively satisfying as anything I'd ever did of my own. I mean,
right.
I had no problems with it at all. But you know, then the record business fell apart. Yeah, and so I started doing other things, and then the blues is what sort of drew me back into music again.
Yeah. So you also have like a digital marketing company, is that right?
I did. I mean, I saw that was through the detour I took. You know, when the music business fell apart, I'd done A&R and sort of producing at a label called Rhino Records,
right?
Which old reissue label, and then there's a spinoff company called Shout Factory,
right?
And so with both of those labels, that's a part of the music business that's very marketing driven, right? It's like you're not signing Lady Gaga or or Lizzo.
Repackaging, reissues.
You're repackaging previously released stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it by definition is a marketing exercise, right? Like how do you convince people to buy something they've already bought before, right?
Yeah.
So I learned a lot about marketing. I must learn more about marketing than producing working at those labels.
Yeah.
And so I got interested in marketing. It's sort of a creative discipline, and so that led me into sort of the world of marketing. It was at a time when, Facebook and Twitter and the iPhone and all this stuff was, coming around and people were learning this new world order. And so I was sort of at the ground floor of that. And so I started a digital marketing company, and then that was like my world for like 5 years. And it was fun. That was a suit world. I mean, then I was, and it was great. And it was heady. And I went all over the world, teaching, companies how to, tell their stories on these digital platforms. And it was a lot of fun, but it was also really corporate and really soul sucking in a lot of ways. And I just, wanted to get back to, my creative head more. And so, and then, like I said, I the blues started sort of bit me in the ass and, hasn't let go.
What an amazing journey, man.
Yeah, it's been a wild ride, man. It's been a wild ride.
Yeah.
I'm grateful for it.
Yeah. I'm grateful you're here. I'm grateful that there's someone like you out there making music.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, man.
Thank you.
Have you ever written a book? Is there like a book I didn't find out there?
No, the cookies and milk thing that you read,
yeah.
That was put on Huffington Post, was going to be the start of a memoir I was going to do. And just writing those few chapters for Huffington Post sort of was like enough. I'm like, okay, that got out of my system. I'm actually working on a kid's book right now.
Oh, really?
Hopefully will come out in the next year or so. That's sort of about a semi fictionalized version of me as a kid growing up in a cookie store.
Okay, cool.
And so I'm working on that, but I'd like to write a book. I've written screenplays, I've written songs, and I've done a lot of essays, and I'd like to write a book before it's all over.
Damn. So we'll see. Well, I anxiously await that book. What's on the horizon? Like, I was meant to ask you, sorry, when you were talking about that you did the digital marketing stuff. Are you the one that sort of produces and puts together those videos that your quarantine videos for you and the brotherhood?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the fun part about, I think it's true for any independent artist, right? I mean, it's like, it's part of the joy of the time we're living in right now, right? I mean, whereas on one level, the economic model's completely changed and so many artists are, not making as much money as they used to. But on the other hand, the gatekeepers have gone away and the barrier of entry is like, really low for anyone. And I think the artists who are, the most successful, whether they be, Jack White or to Beyonce, are the ones who really embrace taking hold of all the creative reins of their, musical life, right? So it's like, you got to write your song, you got to record your song, but then what's the video and what's the, what's the tour going to be like? And, how are you going to use your social media channels? And what do you have to say? And who's going to give a shit? And so I love all that. I mean, I really embrace sort of the full range of all of these sort of these palettes. You know what I mean? And
yeah.
There's just so many different palettes to paint on. And particularly now, not being able to tour, it's like it's a real challenge. How do you stay in touch, with your fans? And how do you sort of stay engaged? And how do you maintain having something to say that anyone is going to give a damn about. And I struggle with it a lot, but I love, I went to film school, like I told you. So, yeah. I love visual media. I mean, some of my best friends and my biggest sort of, heroes are photographers, and filmmakers. And, so I love hanging around, visual artists. And so, we have a lot of great video content that I'm really proud of. And a lot of the videos that other people have produced and directed. And, I guess I've produced them all, but, lately I've been directing more stuff myself. So the quarantine videos are sort of, my creations. And there's a video for Stranger Than Today that my daughter's in, and I directed and filmed that. And it's been fun to sort of just, roll up my sleeves. And
is that the one where you're in the car?
Yeah, it's actually a road trip to Austin. Yeah. It's a road trip from Dallas to Austin.
Nice. Nice.
Yeah, caught a little a special moment between us. She'd just come back from college, and we were sort of that video, more than I even thought it would, sort of caught a moment in my relationship with my daughter where we were rebuilding our relationship, in the wake of the divorce with her mother, and she stepping out into the world in first time as a student in college, and it's just it captures the sort of the fragility of our relationship, and also the depth of it. I love that little video.
It's beautiful.
Happy. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, man, I want to hear more from you, like musically, read your writing. This is
thank you.
It's really been great digging into your music and into your life, which sounds kind of creepy. But it was done as research.
I gotcha.
And definitely, like, man, stay in touch. I'd love, like, when people start playing again, I would love to come see you guys play.
Yeah, I love. Look forward to seeing Austin, man. I miss Austin. So
yeah, man. Is there anything? 3 hours away. I know there's a lot of stuff we didn't cover, but also I have to thank you for whatever segue we got into talking about the record. Oh, because you were talking about Frisco and you made the record outside of Austin. And then that was because that whole entry to the thing, I was like, well, how am I going to get back to the album now? So thank you.
Takes a village.
You co-hosted the show.
Please.
Yeah.
I was in good hands.
Yeah. Well, dude, thank you so much. People can find you at SeanAmos.com. It's the Reverend Sean Amos and the Brotherhood, their brand new album, Blue Skies, out now. Videos, all that stuff, find it at SeanAmos.com. And thank you so much for doing the show. It was a real pleasure meeting you.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah. I love the conversation.
I'm a big fan.
Appreciate it, man. I look forward to seeing you in person soon.
Yeah. Thanks, buddy.
I keep the faith.
You too. The Reverend Sean Amos from the Reverend Sean Amos and the Brotherhood, their latest album, Blue Sky, available now wherever it is you stream and download your jams. Find them at SeanAmos.com. What a great conversation, man. What a fantastic, fantastic meeting that guy. I'll put links to his essay, Hiding in Plain Sight, that came out last Saturday, and his notes from the Rev section of his SeanAmos.com of his website. And also I'm going to put links to his Cookies and Milk scenes from his 70s childhood and other amazing four-part essay about growing up in Los Angeles with his mother, Shirley May, and his dad, Wally Famous Amos, and hookers and drug dealers that knew him by name. Great, great, great story. Great, great guy. What a great conversation, man. Get out there and check out the album Blue Sky. It's absolutely gorgeous. His bandmates, The Brotherhood, Brady Blade, Christopher Thomas, and Dr. Roberts, all there. Go to SeanAmos.com. And gang, don't forget, when you're out there checking out SeanAmos.com, you can find us and find our podcast wherever it is you stream and download your podcast, be it Spotify, YouTube, TuneIn, Stitcher, Overcast, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you find it. New shows all the time. Okay, thank you so much for listening to the show. Let's listen to the rest of this song, Troubled Man, from the Reverend Sean Amos and the Brotherhood, from their album Blue Sky. This song also features the great talent Ruthie Foster. I need to get her on the show sometime. Still, I've never talked to her. I need to get her on the show immediately. Have a great weekend, whatever it is you're doing, gang. Let's get down. Oh.
troubled man.
Troubled man.